Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And this could be a very interesting hour in a number of ways. I'm not sure we've connected with my guest yet. And, oh, you're there. Okay, well, we take that off the plate. And I'll tell you why else it might be an interesting hour in a minute or two. And it has to do with my guest. But first, a few ginger snaps here. Stuff on the news from my wife. One of these is a little older, and I just wanted to come back to it because it's just an important thing. In Europe, you know, they've been trying to do this massive study of the human brain. They've put in $2.7 billion because we waste that much probably every day in the U.S. and lose track of it and don't know where it went. But to the Europeans, that's a lot. U.S. $2.7 billion to map the brain, and they've been going and running into conflict with different people in their attempts to map the brain. They've gotten rid of the cognitive psychologists, for example, probably because being cognitive, they're a little more sophisticated. And what they're looking at is the fact that people are dropping out of this because they feel, some of the more outstanding researchers in Europe, that it is far too premature to think that we understand the human brain enough to try in some depth and detail to map it. And that I am in 100% agreement with. I don't know about the mapping issue, but that we have virtually no fundamental knowledge of how the brain works. We don't know whether really how many neurons there are. One of the estimates is, used to be 100 billion. I think now they're down 86 billion. We estimate that neuroscientists are estimating that the connections run into the trillions. You know, we know that that some neurons have 10,000 connections. And we don't know the operating system. We have no idea how we get from that lump of jello to me talking to you on the radio and you disagreeing with me. So, you know, folks, we're just not there yet. And anybody who tries to tell you they know some sort of a fundamental cause for bipolar disorder and or some fundamental biochemical imbalance that does this or that is just selling you something. Because our knowledge of brain-mind connections, even in the most rudimentary fashion, is simply not there. Another thing I came across so interesting is E. Fuller Torrey, the notorious biological psychiatrist who thought that some virus that cats carried causes schizophrenia, which he sure is a biological disorder. E. Fuller Torrey has come out and said that yeah, of course, a significant percentage of patients diagnosed schizophrenic, he calls them schizophrenics, don't need drugs. Why, we've known that forever, that drugs aren't for everybody. Well, in fact, let me give you a little, and you can find out about this, just Google E. Fuller Torrey. So let me tell you a little bit about his background that brings you back into my past. Back in the mid-1980s, there was an attack on my medical license sponsored by the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill for remarks I made on Oprah Winfrey, critical of psychiatric drugs. And the American Psychiatric Association had its name on all the materials, stamped on property of American Psychiatric Association, on all the materials that were sent to the medical licensure people in my state of Maryland at the time. So it was clearly a collaborative effort. Now, I won that. I won that hands down, but not after a lot of money and aggravation. and other things, but I won it hands down. It ended up that I was completely exonerated. It was declared strictly a freedom of speech issue by the licensure people. And furthermore, they sent me an apology letter and thanked me for my contributions to mental health in the state of Maryland. And that enormous attack on me, which was very persistent in the beginning before they caved in, by the way, the reason they caved in mostly was my wife, Ginger, generated an enormous amount of publicity. She got the New York Times to cover it 3 times. Dan Goldman covered it. She got the Post to cover it, AP to cover it. She just got all sorts of folks to just pitch in and cover it. Now, the outcome was so positive that it enabled me to have my first big-selling book published, Toxic Psychiatry. But where was E. Fulitori? Fulitori was going around saying that this was a very important legal case and that Bregan had said bad things on the air. E. Fulitori went so far as to, when he had affiliations at NIMH, to cancel a conference being put on by consumers, you know, by the psychiatric patient movement. I was going to give them a talk down in a southern state, and E. Fulitori got the funding withdrawn because I was going to be speaking at the conference. E. Fulitori debated me once in his life on one of the big public radio shows. And during the debate, he said that antipsychotic drugs were specific for schizophrenia, and if they affected somebody, it was only because they were a latent schizophrenic. And I said to E. Fulitori, well, then how come we use it in veterinary medicine? How come you can put it in a tranquilizer dart and shoot a lion with it and wait a few minutes and then the lion won't attack you when you go up to examine him? How come it's used to treat vicious sows that are out of control? How come my dog, Blue, when we inadvertently gave him one in the form of a anti-nausea drug to get in the car, suddenly became, for the first time in his life, a docile dog who was obedient? How come all latent schizophrenics, all them sows and lions and dogs? And, of course, he never debated me again. So this is E. Fulitori now climbing on the bandwagon of that, of course, lots of schizophrenics will get better if you don't treat them with antipsychotic drugs. I think it's just unconscionable. So that for my introduction. And now let me get to tell you about my guest. I don't know what's going to happen in this hour. This sounds like a very interesting, worthwhile man to interview. He's never been on the radio before. I've had a few guests. You know, Ginger finds these really interesting people and worthwhile people, and I've had a number who've never been on the radio before, but I don't usually announce it, but this man's really strong, and this is, it won't scare him, and I asked his permission to say that he'd never been on the radio before, and I'm proud, actually, to have him on the radio for the first time. His name is Richard Lawhern, L-A-W-H-E-R-N. And he's recently learned about Mad in America, and he has been talking with them and looking at what psychiatrists do to their patients and so on. And how he got interested in all of this was a number of years ago, his wife, who is doing well now, after some dental surgery, developed what became, diagnosed eventually, I gather, and he may correct me on this, as a case of serious bilateral trigeminal neuralgia, a well-known neurological syndrome with terrible pain that is sometimes helped by anticonvulsive agents like Tegretol, which eventually happened for his wife. But throughout this process, he's gotten very interested in facial pain and in other things related to psychiatry, and he is not written, that shouldn't be related to psychiatry, and has run into the horrible truth that my field often diagnoses people with psychosomatic disorders in order to drug them when they don't have a psychosomatic disorder. And I can tell you now, having been in this field for maybe half a century or more than half a century, as some of you know, that psychosomatic medicine has been largely a fraud. And we're going to get into that today. It's been largely a way of blaming the patient for stuff that is not under the control of the patient's psyche. Sure, even MS, if you're calmer, you'll do a little better, at least for a while. And even if you have tardive dyskinesia from a psychiatric drug and you've got horrible abnormal movements, if you're relaxed for a little bit, they may less, and you might even be able to gain some control over them. But they're not. These are not psychosomatic disorders. These are, well, tardive dyskinesia is inflicted by psychiatry and other doctors giving these antipsychotic drugs. So with this, I hope, interesting introduction, how are you doing, Richard? Are you there?
Good. Yeah, just
well,
fine
listen,
here. And
the ball's in your court now. Take over for a while.
Okay, very, very good, and thank you for being so gracious. I've been talking with and working with chronic face pain patients now for something on the order of 18 years, and my interest in areas that overlap your expertise has been relatively more recent, but that interest has come out of talking with literally hundreds of patients who have been told in one way or another that they are catastrophizing, boy, is that an interesting word, catastrophizing their pain, that they really couldn't possibly feel that badly, that they're depressed, and perhaps their depression has caused them to experience pain, that they're anxious, and trust me, patients that go through the kind of pain I see every day are, they have good reasons to be depressed and anxious. But what is perhaps most offensive to the most people who are dealing with severe and truly difficult medical disorders, and chronic face pain is not the only one, is the notion that somehow or other, something that they have been thinking or some early childhood trauma or something they don't remember has been acting in their awareness in some way that actually causes them to experience pain. Sometimes they're even told they have phantom pain. And unfortunately, that term is rather mixed up in a lot of people, because phantom pain is a legitimate medical entity. It refers to a central nervous system problem that is a consequence of the nervous system not quite being able to figure out where its peripheries are, where the borders of its nerves are anymore. It's also sometimes called deafferentiation pain, which is a real hard thing to treat.
So you're talking about where people have lost limbs or portions of their limbs, right?
Yeah, or in the case of face pain patients, people who have had a surgical procedure that puts a lesion on the nerve in an effort to...
They'll get phantom pain too.
Yeah, they'll get, or
oh,
something
good.
Like
I've
it.
Learned something. Mm-hmm. Good.
Or something like
yeah.
it. Because what's happening there, especially with people who've had a full nerve section, is that the former periphery of the nerves are cut off from sensible awareness of the central nervous system. And you get a situation where the nervous system is saying, hey, where are you? And it starts signaling. And it signals until it thinks it's going to get through whatever is blocking the return signal. And when it's doing all of that signal, what it's doing is generating enormous, sharp stabs of pain in the face. So
wow.
I started asking a question of people after I talked with quite some number of them. I said, you've been referred to mental health for some reason. What did your doctor tell you? And I heard about the medical doctors who were doing this referral. Well, my doctor sort of ran out of options, and he didn't know what exactly was wrong with me, except that I had a kind of pain he didn't recognize. At first, he called it atypical facial pain, and then he said eventually to me, I don't know exactly what's going on here, but I can't detect any medical reason for the pain that you're describing. And I think you really ought to see a psychiatrist for evaluation, because I'm concerned that there may be a psychosomatic problem operating here. And it sometimes doesn't come out quite that clearly, but the bottom line to a lot of patients is, I don't know what your problem is, for sure, medically, so I think we ought to really eliminate the possibility that you've got a screw loose between your ears. The logic for that is one that is very, very strong and very much a current issue in a lot of places besides chronic pain patients. But in chronic pain patients of all kinds, it can literally kill the patient. And that's not a casual assertion. It turns out there's recent data, very, very good study, and a very large study done by the U.S. Veterans Administration that demonstrates that the risk of suicide among chronic pain patients who have a legitimate disorder of some kind that's been well diagnosed, one of, let's say, seven really big ones that are non-cancer pain, somebody that's in that situation who gets a diagnosis of so-called psychogenic pain has a 250% increase in the risk of suicide. And that risk is not from their primary disorder, it's from the diagnosis.
Richard,
that really
ought
to engage us.
Yeah. Richard, that's dramatic and striking. Do you have the citation for my listeners, or can you email it to me and I'll get it to them later?
I can email it to you, and I can also look it up if you're interested just a minute.
Well, during the break, maybe you could do that. Because that's very dramatic. And also email me the paper if you can. It's not surprising, but it's shocking that when you get a psychiatric diagnosis, when indeed you have a legitimate medical disorder, it causes you greater despair, greater self-hate and self-punishment. I'm sure that happens. It makes a lot of sense.
Well, there's one more aspect of it. That greater, if you call it self-hate, I'm not sure I'd use those words, but the diagnosis
also... Well, those
also,
were spur of the moment. I could even withdraw them. But it demoralizes you. How's that?
It certainly does demoralize you, but more importantly, it reliably causes your doctor to distrust your reports.
Yeah.
Your medical doctors, from there on out, are going to see you as a suspect patient who probably can't be fully trusted or validated to report their own conditions. That results in patients being undertreated, under-medicated for pain, and frequently discounted as members of their own treatment teams. And that is truly demoralizing. And this I can give your users right away, or your users, I'm sorry, your listeners right away, one reference that they can find very easily in any search engine. The title of the article is Psychogenic Pain and Iatrogenic Suicide. It sounds like a mouthful. But psychogenic means anything that is caused by what's going on in your psyche. And iatrogenic means anything that is caused by the treatment that a doctor delivers. So what we're saying is that a diagnosis, that is, and the treatment that comes from the diagnosis for supposedly psychogenic pain may in fact be a source of suicide that the doctor, him or herself, has caused. That is not a trivial assertion, but the paper is indeed referenced, and you can go back and find through that paper the original article that was generated, the paper that was generated by the... So...
Well, wait a minute. You haven't given us the reference, though. Can you do
I'm
that?
I'm sorry.
Do that at the break if you can. All right, so the title, Psychogenic Pain...
And Iatrogenic Suicide.
Okay, it's iatrogenic, the IAT, iatrogenic suicide, and that'll bring up the paper. Great.
That's right. It'll be one of the top three.
Okay.
One of the top three. So, if you want to continue, fine, do. Otherwise, I'll add a few details around the edges of all this.
No, I'm happy to have you go on.
Okay. What I basically do, and I want to be really sure that I'm careful to make this qualification, I'm not a doctor. At least I'm not a doctor of medicine. I'm a doctor of engineering. I spent 45 years of my life reading complicated technical papers and understanding vocabulary that is at least daunting and sometimes worse. And engineers are not good writers, trust me. So I developed the ability to kind of understand a lot of stuff that I was reading, even when it was unfamiliar. When my wife came down with a level of pain that put her in tears, I, of course, I told her, let's go get you looked at by somebody, and that's what they're doing. Six doctors later, we had a diagnosis from a neurologist who said, I don't often treat this disorder, but I believe you have a form, actually two forms of facial pain that are called a neuralgia. And a neuralgia is basically an inflammation of some sort, usually of a specific nerve, and that inflammation causes pain. I don't treat this, but there is an association of people who are very active in information for it, and I think I'd like you to go talk to the United States Trigeminal Neuralgia Association. So basically what all of this amounted to after quite a bit of money and time was, he said, I don't know what I know what you have, I think, but I don't treat it, so go talk to people who have it, which we did. And we were very fortunate to find a local support group meeting, one of many that the TNA supports all across the country and overseas. We happened to be there the night that the president of the association, a lovely lady named Claire Patterson, was there and was speaking. And I asked what is best described as a dumb question from the audience. I said, have you guys done anything about making your presence and your assistance more visible in the Internet? Now, realize we're talking about 1997. So this is a wise back. And she looked at me and crooked her finger, and she said, come talk to me after the meeting. I still smile over that, because Claire is one of the most persuasive people you could ever meet, and she's very, very active in medical circles and has been for years in trying to get this disorder recognized. It's a rare disorder, one of about roughly 3,000 rare disorders. But I went and talked to her, and she said, you know, what do you have in mind about using the Internet to help people understand what they're going through here? And from that, things sort of proceeded. And after another year or so, I was asked to join their board of directors for the association and to take over as webmaster of their homepage. At that time, the homepage was being hosted by the Massachusetts General Hospital. In the time since then, if you took the term trigeminal neuralgia and you gave it to a search engine like Google or web crawler or one of the others, in 1997, it would have turned back about 4,000 references, hits, as they're called. I ran this exercise last fall, and that 4,000 has now turned into 1,400,000 in the last 18 years. And some of those hits are on stuff I've written. And a lot of them, of course, are on much more authoritative sites. There, you can find the disorder anywhere you want to go for it right now, if you know what you're looking for. If you know you're looking for something about face pain, it's a little bit harder, but it's still pretty good. I get about, roughly 3,000 to 4,000 visits on my website every month, and the great bulk of them are from people who have looked up the term pain in my face. And there are many other sources, many of them much more medically authoritative than I am. So what I do as a medical layman is I help people to understand what they're dealing with, to find doctors who know what they're dealing with, and to basically to assess on a person-to-person social networking basis, what are my options? What can I do? I'm in horrible pain. I'm not getting results from my present medication. My doctor is throwing up his hands and basically saying, I don't know what to do for you. My general practitioner had never seen a case of this and was really very surprised.
Let me interrupt a minute. My general impression is that trigeminal neuralgia now is that when I was in medical school back in the 60s was already known, and that, as you're saying, it's very broadly known now. The standard treatment now, pretty much, the starting treatment for it is likely to be Tegretol, right?
That's the drug of choice. It's not the only one. Yes.
Yep.
That's
so
quite true. Medication is the first
step. Are people
step.
Still throwing up their hands? And if so, what are they throwing up their hands about? That the Tegretol is not working, or they'd never heard of the proper treatment?
Well,
I'm confused.
Both. And both.
I'm genuinely confused.
What we've got,
I'm trying to get you to explain just what's happening right now, because I can't believe that doctors right now don't know about trigeminal neuralgia.
Well, the first person that a patient normally sees, Peter, is going to be a dentist, because they got pain
they
in their cheek.
Don't they know what it is?
The dentists have a total of 8 hours of instruction in dental school on neurologic disorders. Most of them go looking for temporomandibular joint disorder.
They don't even think about it. No, this is interesting.
They don't think about it.
The dentists don't think about it. Wow.
And, you know, I talk to patients who basically say, this whole mess started after a dentist treated me. And in some cases, what's happening is that somebody has injected I forget which nerve it is, but there is a nerve that's basically involved in the jaw.
Well, it's the fifth nerve. It's the trigeminal nerve.
Right, but you can also get pain emerging after a standard injection deep into a nerve in the jaw as a part of dental anesthesia. And the mechanism there is probably neuropathy of some kind rather than neuralgia, because there's more than one form of this.
Yeah. So tell me, ask you a couple of questions. So the person sees a dentist. And who do they then end up with next? Is it a GP or is it a neurologist?
Well, it could be a number of things. The dentist might send you to a dental surgeon who is generally more trained and more specialized.
I would certainly hope that one of them knew what trigeminal, could recognize trigeminal neuralgia.
It's not always easy, because the symptoms overlap. So-called TMJ disorder, and there's more than one medical entity in the face.
Yeah. So let's stop a minute. Hang on a minute. Stop a minute. You're used to doing lectures, and you do them great. You're doing a great job. I want to get you in a little bit more of a conversation. TMJ, folks, is the problem with it. Why don't you tell folks what TMJ is, so they know what's getting confused with the trigeminal neuralgia.
TMJ is what happens when your jaw locks up, or you get clicking in the joint of the jaw, because the temporomandibular joint, that's a horribly long term, I realize, but it's the one that lets your jaw drop when you open your mouth. And if you have a structural problem in the joint or debris in it, and you can't move your jaw freely, you can build up pain in the actual joint and referred pain in other places in your face and even on the side of your head.
Yeah, I slept on the wrong. I slept too hard on my jaw one night, and I had that for a few days. So we're going to go to break in a minute, Richard. But one of the things that confuses it then is TMJ and with the trigeminal neuralgia. And when we come back, you can talk about a couple of other things, whatever your experience is in getting, you know, and why the diagnosis becomes a problem. And then probably my audience is going to want to, and I want to hear more about how the psychiatrists get involved in this and how you got so involved in the psychiatric issues that you ended up, you know, involving yourself in the conversations on Mad in America. So we're going to go to break now. My wonderful engineer Giselle is right on target, I'm sure, and we'll start the music. And when we come back, we'll go on with that and then return to this fascinating issue. You brought up incredible things about psychogenic pain, suicide, the failure, how bad it is when psychiatrists and other doctors misdiagnose it and call it psychiatric. I think that's a model we want to explore some more when we come back. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. The Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, as always, bringing you pioneers in the general field of human beings, psychology, psychiatry, but spirituality, living life, self-development. And today is, I think, a startlingly interesting and informative guest. a man I haven't met and one of the few guests I've had who, it turns out, is really didn't know much about me at all when we got in touch with each other. His name is Richard Lawhern. And he can be, Richard, you can be located just by Googling you fairly easily. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah, the easy way is my website. It's lawhern.org.
That's great. Shows us that you've been around a while, that you have a simple website.
I've been doing online research for the last, or since 1988. So I've been around a while.
Yeah. Now, during the break, Richard gave me enough information to get two of the most interesting articles I've heard about. One is written by the VA, and the author is Mark Elgen, I-L-G-E-N, and it's called Non-Cancer Pain Conditions and Risk of Suicide, it's in JAMA 2013. I'm going to try to get it, but in my experience, you can probably Google it. If you're associated with a university, obviously you can order it. And the other is on the apparently on the website of the Division of Humanistic Psychology of APA, folks I know very well. And the URL for that, if you got a pencil. Well, let me give you the title first, because it'll tell you why you might want to get it. This is the article, Psychogenic Pain Iatrogenic
Suicide.
And iatrogenic suicide. Psychogenic Pain and Iatrogenic Suicide. July 5th, 2013, on a page that's name begins with Global Summit, and the way you get to it is the URL is DX, like diagnosis, I guess, dxsummit.org/archives/1002. So one more time, DX, like diagnosis, and summit, dxsummit.org/archives/1002. So I'd like to continue on this theme because I think it is incredibly new to me and therefore I'm sure to some other folks, which is that people have been studying how applying psychiatric diagnoses to legitimate pain syndromes causes untold misery and, as you put it bluntly, death. Can you just take off on that some more?
Yeah, and I would. Let me, if I can do this, I won't do it at great length. I'll read you the short synopsis of the psychogenic pain article. It's only four lines. A recent large sample analysis investigated the association between several named chronic pain conditions and suicide. This analysis provides suggestive evidence that thousands of patients who have been diagnosed with a psychiatric condition called psychogenic pain may have been placed at greater risk of suicide by the diagnostic label itself. Like much of psychosomatic medicine, the diagnosis lacks medical evidence of validity. And that was really the point that I wanted to make in the paper. And again, by way of protecting the interests of your listeners, remember, my PhD is in engineering. It's not in medicine.
You don't have to worry about that. We don't need caveats here. We're really just interested in reason. So this is not a show we're going to apologize for having something to say. You're your own authority here, my friend.
I think this is important. This is reflective. Now, you wanted to know a little more about development of the theme in terms of where my concerns come from and what I've seen on patients basically being damaged by psychiatrists and by others in the mental health field when that kind of a label gets applied to them. I got interested in that because I was repeatedly talking to people in a group that's called Ben's Friends, which is a group of online social networking communities that focus on rare and unusual diseases and disorders. And people who have rare disorders very frequently have a very horrible time getting a diagnosis. It takes a long time. People do tests. They go around in circles trying to figure out what the alternatives are. And these things are so rare that an individual doctor may not see one of these disorders in an entire 40-year career. So, you know, you got to give the doctors some slack, too. They're dealing with something that's brand new, and it's often subtle, and it's hard. But some of them run out of patients, and when they do, they tell patients, well, I don't think there's anything medically wrong with you. I think you ought to see a shrink. And then it becomes very much harder for any patient to get appropriate medical examination and treatment from that point out. So dealing with people who are in this situation, in this case specifically for face pain, talking with them for years and years as an online researcher and support moderator in more than one site, I hear the story and I say, well, let's ask a question. And I went to the management at Ben's Friends and I said, I want to mount a survey. I want to ask patients about their experience when they've been referred by a medical doctor for a mental health evaluation. And we put out the word. And we got back a relatively limited number of answers to our survey, but it was a very detailed survey. There were 30 questions, and people were allowed to write a fairly long narrative about what their experience had been and how it had affected them. And we got a rather fascinating picture. The people who were referred for mental health, and we were talking about a fairly small group here, just a hair under 200 that we got back from soliciting 30,000. People who are willing to talk about this basically told us that when they were referred to a mental health professional, it was often over their own objection, but they were told, I won't treat you further unless you have this evaluation. When the mental health guy, whoever that was, usually a psychiatrist, but not always, when the mental health guy came back, they received, well, let's put it this way, at least half of that 200 folks that we talked to had gotten three different psychiatric diagnoses from the same doctor. And of those who were treated with psychoactive medications, more than two-thirds of them had no improvement of condition whatever. The results of this were summarized on on Psychology Today, interestingly enough. And I'll get you that one, that URL at a later time, but it was in the blog Saving Normal that is written by Dr. Alan Francis. Dr. Francis, by the way, headed up the task force that wrote the fourth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. And he's been a very profound and sharp critic of the whole DSM process and of the DSM fifth edition.
Well, we're not so admiring of him in my community of friends, but I understand where you're coming from. He must look like a breath of fresh air. I view
well,
him
yes
as an
and no.
Yeah,
yes
I view him
no.
as an
I needed a venue. I needed a venue, and I ran into him, and he was willing to take my results and present them under a particular concern, interestingly enough, that is part of the DSM process. And that concern, I think, we can share more widely because it's not just his. The DSM made it very much easier for people to be diagnosed with so-called psychosomatic disorders and to be diagnosed on less grounds. And one of the absolute worst conditions and the most unscientific that was invented out of thin air in the DSM-5 is a nasty little problem called somatic symptom disorder. And what it now comprises is if you have great anxiety and concern and worry about a problem that you have medically, that a medical doctor or anybody else judges to be disproportionate. In other words, it's their judgment that's operating here. It's not necessarily any objective condition, and it's certainly not test data. But if the doctor thinks that you're over-concerned with your medical condition because you won't give up or allow yourself to be medicated for anxiety, he can give you a medical diagnosis that will complicate your treatment for the rest of your life, and it may kill you. And there's a very good reason for that, and I'll give you another reference. This one's hard to find right now. There was a lady about 2 years ago who was a university professor who came down with breathing problems. She was having difficulty breathing properly. She was in London. or near London, university professor, very educated, very competent individual. She had two doctors in the British National Health System tell her, well, we think you're depressed and that your breathing is a consequence of some anxiety condition. We don't really think you need any other examination. So we're going to prescribe antidepressants, and we'll monitor you periodically. Well, 6 months later, when they monitor her, they found out that she had a cancer condition in her lungs that eventually killed her, because she had been diagnosed with depression, and basically, when you get right down to it, considered to be a head case. She was not investigated appropriately medically, and it killed her. Somatic symptom disorder can do the very same thing, because it is largely a matter of opinion rather than observation or evaluation when that diagnosis is assigned. So far, we don't know just how often it will be assigned, but patients are really up in arms about having that label tacked onto them. And there's another wrinkle. If a parent of a child is overly anxious in a doctor's judgment that the child has a problem that has not been medically appropriately treated, the parent can be diagnosed with somatic symptom disorder, and in extreme cases, the parent's custody of the child can be turned over to the state. And if you think that makes me angry, you don't know the half of it. This has actually happened.
Have you been following the Pelletier case?
Absolutely.
Well, give a little summary of that for the folks.
Well, I realize I'd not deeply studied on it, but the bottom line was that a young woman who had a medically diagnosed and fairly subtle problem, she was in her teens, she was taken to a regional medical center because she was in difficulty. She was having problems in a wide variety, and they were serious problems. But she had a diagnosed medical disorder. However, the staff at that regional center,
let me interrupt, because I do know more. I can give you a little quick capsule on
go.
It. Pelletier was a young woman, and she was being treated for something called mitochondrial disorder, which is recognized by the medical establishment, NIH, and so on. She was being treated at Boston City for that. Her GI doctor moved to another hospital, a children's hospital in Boston, and she had to go through the ER to get admitted to see her GI doc. Psychiatry was called. Psychiatry took over. Psychiatry removed her from her parents. Psychiatry got her parents cut off from her and even removed their parental rights over her, and proceeded to drug her instead of treating her properly. And the child was reduced to a wreck. The last I heard, finally, after months and months of the court siding with psychiatry and with the child welfare, division of whatever it's called in the city of Boston, she's finally begun to work her way back to her parents. But it's a classic. They diagnosed her with somatic symptom disorder, or somatoform disorder, is what they were calling it, somatoform disorder. That's
right. The somatoform disorder is the earlier version of this thing. In the fourth edition of DSM.
This is very useful, what you're saying about the changes in the fifth edition. You're giving a lot of terrific information on this, on your first radio show, let me tell you.
I hope so.
So
there's another little term here, Peter, that I think would also be registered with quite a number of your listeners. The term is chronic fatigue syndrome. And a related term is functional neurologic symptom disorder, sometimes parenthesized conversion disorder.
Now, where is that now standing in the fifth, the DSM-5?
It's in the DSM-5, and it is accepted as a diagnosis in the DSM-5. And if you'll pardon my observation as a layman, it's a crock. I won't say what of. But... frankly, the whole idea around conversion disorder is that early trauma can be converted into very serious neurological symptoms that have no real medical explanation. And it becomes a psychiatric disorder once you have that hung on you. And as a psychiatric disorder, it's treated rather ineffectively by a number of means, some of them drugs and some of them so-called cognitive behavioral therapy. And frankly, patients don't get better. I've talked to a few of them, and frankly, I think they're being sold down the river by psychiatry. These are people who have genuine problems, but they're basically being disregarded as observers of their own medical conditions and told, you have a problem, but it's all in your head. And frankly, I think that's nonsense. And I don't think there's a bit of science under those kinds of assertions with regard to anything in the psychosomatic medicine toolbox. There's another book, by the way, that I'll urge people to go take a look for. It's a hard reading book, but professionals ought to have it on their shelves. It's by Angela Kennedy. It's on Amazon, and the book title is Authors of Our Own Misfortune: Problems with Psychogenic Explanations for Physical Disease. And it is hair-raising. Kennedy is a sociologist. She's a lecturer in the UK university system. And she's done a very workmanlike job of demonstrating that the entire field of psychosomatic medicine is based on mythology and on impression and on opinion. And there is almost no valid medical data to justify any of it. So,
I want to say that this is my experience, too. You know, one of the most shocking experiences in my practice in the past few years has been my referring patients with obvious neurological disorders, not even to psychiatrists, because I'm a psychiatrist, I don't need to do that, but to neurologists who on at least three occasions in my practice have told patients it's all in your head. One of these people figured out for herself, and I figured out with her, that she had MS, and I sent her to a neurological group that I respected, but the doctor that saw her, I had not met, didn't know at all, and he told her literally it was all in her head. Now, the odd thing is you think, well, if you think you have MS and somebody tells you it's psychological, you'll feel better. No, people don't. They know there's something wrong that's physical, and they get demoralized when they're told it's in their head. Because for one thing, now they know they have something physically wrong, and somebody else thinks they have something psychiatrically wrong. It's not a good feeling. Richard, one thing I want to address before we finish, and we've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left, is everything you're saying, and I'm sure you've figured this out too, but everything you're saying about what happens when somebody with a genuine disorder, whether it's a breathing disorder like you cited, or whether it's a pain disorder like you have so much wonderful, amazing information about, when a person is told that they have a psychiatric disorder instead of or on top of it, it leads to demoralization, potentially to suicide, especially if the disorder is one that's hard to deal with, the real disorder. And secondly, it invalidates you with all your future caregivers. Well, of course, the same thing is true if you go to a doctor with an emotional problem. It, too, has causes: stress, marital issues, work issues, childhood abuse issues. And then you're told you have a mental disorder. You're put in exactly the same position that Richard's describing, even though you have an emotional problem. You're basically demoralized, and from then on, no matter what issue you have with your doctor, you have to be afraid that any doctor you go to who knows you have the psych diagnosis is not going to take you quite as seriously. I literally recommend to my patients, I recommend to people on the air here, that if you want to get the best medical care you can from your doctor, don't go in telling him you feel stressed. Don't go in telling her that you feel anxious or depressed. Go in explaining your physical symptoms and ask for a physical evaluation. Then, if you want to ask the doctor about your emotional issues, which could be a mistake, you might want to search hard instead for some sort of a therapist, a marriage and family therapist, a clinical social worker, because it's dangerous to tell doctors about emotional problems because they'll drug you. It's really very dangerous to tell medical docs about emotional problems. The GPs, they'll spend 3 minutes diagnosing you and drug you. Literally 3 minutes out of the six you get with them or the 10 you get with them. So everything that Richard's saying about pain disorders is totally true for all things that involve any kind of emotionality, because the psychiatric diagnosing and treatment tends to demoralize people, make them feel worse about themselves, and tends to get them bad treatment in the future. I imagine
Peter,
you agree
could I
with
offer
that.
Something?
Sure.
Yeah, could I offer something here? There's another element beginning to be available to patients, and I would say to your listeners, don't by any means ignore this. It's very important. Patients learn as much from each other as they do from doctors. The online mutual support movement, and it is a movement, is very strong, very positive. And what we hear in that movement and in sites that are providing the services of mutual support is, I'm no longer alone. I'm not socially isolated anymore. I'm not powerless anymore. There are people here who understand what I'm going through, who can share their experience with me in a way that actually helps to improve my situation and my conditions. And if I may give a small plug, there's another thing that anybody can find on Google. It's called Ben's Friends. And it has almost 40,000 members in 35 communities for rare disorders. And their job is really, or excuse me, Ben's Friends' mission in life is to put people in touch with each other and with authoritative information. They're by no means the only outfit, but they're the one that I'm associated with. So in a small way, I'll ask to give them a plug. But the whole message is, I get by with a little help from my friends. I actually published an article by that name. And the medical model is one of collaboration rather than authority. You don't let any doctor tell you who you are. You tell the doctor what your issues are. If you feel the need for emotional support, you go to a doctor or a therapist who provides it, and you say to them, I have a serious medical disorder. I have a lot of social isolation. I have a lot of anxiety. These are your mission statement. Can you help me? And you do these things in two different places. With a medical doctor, you ask a medical doctor for medical advice and diagnosis. With a therapist or a mental health practitioner, you basically tell them, these are my conditions. Can you be a supporting member of my team? That gets enormously better results than telling a medical doctor that there's something wrong in your head and having him start the process of pigeonholing you.
Richard,
pardon me, but I'm a little emphatic on this.
It's a perfect place to end. My guest, Richard Lawhern, your website is lawhern.org or .com?
.org.
Lawhern.org, L-A-W-H-E-R-N. I had no idea where this show was going to go. It's gone into really important places. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome. Thank you.